big blockers, the people that wanted Bitcoin to scale to be money for the world, was like 90+% of the ecosystem. It was almost all the businesses and almost all the actual users that were using it. And there was just a very, very loud, vocal, very small minority of people that were going to do everything that they could to block Bitcoin from being able to scale to be money for the world. And a lot of them thought that like limiting the block size, that'll keep Bitcoin decentralized and keep it free. Whereas now we have, you know, almost a decade to look in the rearview mirror there. The small blocks led to more centralization, more censorship. Everybody's using a custodian. People can't afford to transact themselves. So it had the exact opposite effect of what those people were claiming. And so like, I think a lot of them are now starting to realize that, oh, maybe limiting the block size wasn't good for Bitcoin's decentralization. It wasn't good for its freedom promoting aspects. It was actually a net negative for the entire cryptocurrency ecosystem.
This podcast is sponsored by CoinATM Radar. When buying crypto with cash, an ATM is much more reliable and safer than meeting some random person in a random place. And unlike an exchange, which could freeze your account, you truly own all the crypto you buy. With CoinATM Radar, you could find crypto ATMs and other services where you can buy and sell cryptocurrencies for cash. On their website, you can search by coin, address, if the ATM supports selling as well as buying, and you can also search by geo area, country, state, city. You can also check and compare actual current fees at different ATMs. If you want to find out more, head over to coinatmradar.com, which is CoinATMRadar.com. So, hey everyone, I'm joined by the one and only Roger Ver, Bitcoin legend, crypto legend, Bitcoin Jesus. How's it going, man?
Yeah, another day, more excitement in the world of crypto. Hard to believe someone pointed out to me that I'm coming up on 15 years now. I'm not quite at 15 years, but you know, more than 14. So. It's a long time.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's 11 for me, and it was, I think it's 12 since I started talking about Bitcoin, but never actually used it. So yeah, it's long in the tooth. People, these kids these days, they don't know.
Yeah, actually, I was at the Sol, Ethereum Sol or whatever is going on this week. And so yesterday I was there hanging out with some old, you know, longtime crypto friends. And some new guy with some newer project came up, and he's, you know, and I'm just talking with people that have been around, you know, Bitcoin for, I don't know, like a decade plus. And he's like, so are you involved in Bitcoin or what are you focused on? And like, you know, just didn't know who I was, which was fine, but we all kind of got a chuckle out of it as well. So, and he was, you know, ready to tell me about his project, which is fine. I listened, but it was kind of amusing because there's lots of new people that don't know the history of Bitcoin, but that's why, I have a new book coming out that is, I think, the main thing we're going to talk about today, because it's nice to have a book to teach the history, because a lot of people don't actually know what happened within Bitcoin and don't even realize that this will piss off some people, but only if they don't know the history. Like Bitcoin Cash very nearly kept the Bitcoin name and would have kept the BTC ticker symbol and very nearly was what everyone was calling Bitcoin today. And it was just razor thin that it wound up going the other way to where the thing that's called Bitcoin today could have just as easily been called something else.
Yeah.
And what we're calling Bitcoin Cash today could have been called Bitcoin.
Yeah. Which is a pretty interesting dynamic, especially how, you know, differently things turned out. But yeah, when I heard you were writing a book on this kind of stuff, of course I've heard, you know, I was there, you know, I was there at Gandalf. I was there during the block size wars. I experienced my transactions that I was using for everyday purchases change in real time, and to where I had personal hardship. Like I had all that kind of experience. And so for me, this is like old hat story, but, and if it was maybe 2019, 2020 at the latest, if this book came out, it might've been a little, I would say easier to ignore maybe, but just the timing of now, when not only is it fresh for so many people, it's not something anyone knows of a lot of the crypto generation now. It's also coming to an interesting time of soul searching with BTC, the whole Bitcoin community. It's kind of interestingly timed. So why don't you just go through quickly about, just go down the rundown of the book more than you already have.
Yeah. And I guess I'll have to point out, it's just luck with the timing that it's coming out now, but you know, sometimes better lucky than good. But the book itself basically covers the entire, you know, origin of Bitcoin and the history of Bitcoin, all the way up until, like, you know, after the split. And so many people don't realize the amount of censorship and dirty tricks and underhanded, you know, the closed door manipulation that went on to fool people. And so you and I were right there when this all happened, when the block size war really heated up. The big blockers, the people that wanted Bitcoin to scale to be money for the world, was like 90%+ of the ecosystem. It was almost all the businesses and almost all the actual users that were using it. And there was just a very, very loud, vocal, very small minority of people that were going to do everything that they could to block Bitcoin from being able to scale to be money for the world. Not because, I think some of them probably understood it, but a lot of them were just useful idiots in that respect. And a lot of them thought that, like, oh, you know, limiting the block size, that'll keep Bitcoin decentralized and keep it free. Whereas now we have, you know, almost a decade, you know, to look in the rearview mirror there. It had the exact opposite effect. The small blocks led to more centralization, more censorship. Everybody's using a custodian. People can't afford to transact themselves. So it had the exact opposite effect of what those people were claiming. And so, like, I think a lot of them are now starting to realize that, oh, maybe limiting the block size wasn't good for Bitcoin's decentralization. It wasn't good for its freedom promoting aspects. It was actually a net negative for the entire cryptocurrency ecosystem. And you'll see some people that aren't thinking clearly say, oh, Bitcoin's $70,000 today. Bcash is $500. It's like, yeah, well, you're looking at what's seen. What's not seen is where could the entire market cap of all cryptocurrencies have been had Bitcoin not run into these intentionally designed scaling issues, right? When you had companies like Microsoft and Expedia literally stop accepting Bitcoin, and some of them still don't accept Bitcoin again to this very day. And so, like, the entire world could have been in a much better position today than it is had we not ran into that scaling issue that was literally done with a bunch of censorship and dirty tricks that are outlined and cited right there directly in the book. And I think a lot of people's jaws will drop when they realize just how many dirty tricks were played and how much censorship went on within the community. And if I had to pick one single mistake that I made in my strategy and history and involvement in Bitcoin, it's like I underestimated how incredibly effective censorship is. Because at the time when the censorship first started, everybody knew the truth. And I didn't think, who's going to fall for the censorship? But now that so much time has gone by, a lot of people think, like, oh, Roger's, you know, Bitcoin Judas and didn't ever do anything for Bitcoin, and the big blocks were stupid and the Bcash is stupid. And, like, they don't know the censorship was so incredibly effective. And that's why even today, like, if you take a step back and take off your censorship, you know, influenced goggles, you can see Julian Assange is a hero. Edward Snowden is a hero. Yet the government propaganda against these people have fooled the majority of citizens into thinking that these people are bad people and that they did something wrong. And so the same is true with the block size wars. The censorship was so effective into tricking people via the censorship into thinking that big blocks were a bad idea, or that Bitcoin was never supposed to be peer-to-peer electronic cash, even though it's right there in the title of the white paper. And that Satoshi himself, he literally wrote the software code to increase the block size on Bitcoin so it could scale to be money for the world, to compete directly with you know, PayPal and Visa and MasterCard and these sorts of things. Whereas nowadays, you know, and a lot of new people won't know, like, I was one of the, if not the main face of Bitcoin for quite a number of years there. And now we have people like Michael Saylor as one of the main faces of Bitcoin, literally telling people, hey, let's not compete with the US dollar. Let's all pay our taxes. Let's not rock the, you know, let's not, you know, rock the boat at all with this. And it's like, you've missed the entire point of Bitcoin if you think it's not going to rock the boat and it's not going to disrupt the way the entire world works. And sadly, at this point, Bitcoin isn't nearly as disruptive as it otherwise could have been if people could still use it as peer-to-peer electronic cash. So anyhow, the book covers all the ways in which the Civil War, you know, dirty tricks and tactics that were employed to literally undermine Bitcoin's usefulness as peer-to-peer cash for the world. And it's already, you know, at the top of its category on Amazon, and I invite people to go over there and order it. You can go to hijackingbitcoin.com and you can buy it with cryptocurrency, or you can buy it directly on Amazon with, you know, traditional legacy payments, whatever you want, whatever's easiest for you. It's right there available. So please go and grab it, give it a read. If you're old to crypto, it'll be a wonderful walk down memory lane. If you're new to crypto, it's worth your time to learn the history of how we got to where we are today, because as the saying goes, if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. And maybe something similar could even potentially happen again, which I'm sad to say. But anyhow, I thought it was important to get the word out. And myself and Steve Patterson, I think, did a really good job with this book. And so hijackingbitcoin.com.
Yeah. So as far as the whole story, how early does it start, the book, and how late does it end? Like, what's kind of like the beginning and the end, just to encapsulate kind of what's in there?
Yeah, it starts at the beginning of Bitcoin with Satoshi releasing it to the world and the history there, which was even before my time and my involvement in Bitcoin. And then it ends after the BSV split. So so there was a lot. So what happened is that,
yeah,
13 years or something? I know, a while. So,
well, it's kind of been interesting because of the last couple of years, some interesting new things have kind of cropped up. One thing that was kind of interesting was the on the BSV kind of subject was Craig Wright versus COPPA, the trial that happened in the UK. And obviously, it's interesting for a few reasons to me. One thing is the court decided that Craig is not Satoshi, but as a result, a good chunk of the BSV community agreed with the court. They were waiting for the court to tell them whether or not he was Satoshi, and once the court said that, they took that as face value when a week prior they thought he was. And so that's an interesting thing. But the other thing is, as a result of this court case, a lot of the real Satoshis, you know, emails and stuff and communications were brought into the trial and brought out. And anyone who had, you know, this is my biased perspective, but it's one you'd agree with, right? Anyone who had two brain cells could tell from Satoshi's work that he was what would be called today as a on-chain scaler or a big blocker. It was pretty clear, but the emails made it more clear, much more clear, much more clear the vision for scaling and stuff like that. And as a result, I've seen, first of all, a lot of the old guard of the let's call the maxi cult, right? The BTC kind of old guard kind of covering and say Satoshi wasn't perfect. We shouldn't take everything he said as gospel. But then also a lot of newer Bitcoiners who missed the block size wars kind of like getting what they call red-pilled, right? Kind of getting like, oh, this is interesting. Yeah, we should make the blocks bigger. Like, yeah, we should this kind of. And it's an interesting coincidence of that happening and this bombshell of a book coming out kind of around the same time. Isn't it kind of an interesting coincidence?
Yeah, sometimes the universe just kind of works out that way. It was a fantastic timing for the release of the book to happen at the moment, but it was just good luck in that respect. But yeah, those new emails from Satoshi coming out, like even a lot of these Bitcoin maximalists, exactly like you said, they read that, they realized, oh, you know, Satoshi clearly was a big blocker there. And it's fine to have a different opinion. It's fine to think that like blocks, small blocks are a good idea, but like they literally hijacked the Bitcoin name and the Bitcoin project and morphed it into a project that doesn't even remotely resemble the project that I got so excited about, the project you got so excited about, the project Satoshi was excited about building, and they've morphed it into something else. And like, if you want your own project, go and start your own project. Don't hijack an existing project and then gaslight everybody into saying that it was never supposed to be peer-to-peer cash for the world. Like, but that's exactly what happened. And again, this book covers all the details there. Everything from probably one of the juiciest bits that maybe a lot of people don't know is that a man openly claiming to work for a U.S. intelligence agency literally paid Peter Todd to produce small block propaganda and to introduce this thing called replace by fee, which makes Bitcoin far less useful for payments. So literally, a guy claiming to work for the U.S. intelligence agencies was there undermining Bitcoin's usefulness as cash from, you know, the earliest days of Bitcoin. And that's covered right there in the book. It's not even disputed. There's all the citations right there, like for the whole world to see, for anybody that's actually paying attention. And so like, ask yourself, why would U.S. intelligence agencies want Bitcoin to be, would they want it to be more useful or less useful, right? Like, it undermines the U.S. dollar. Of course, they want to do everything they can to make it less useful and less valuable to the world. And the best way they were able to come up with to do that was to trick people into thinking that, oh, let's make the transaction slow, expensive, and unreliable and force everybody to use these custodial platforms. But we'll still call the platforms wallets, even though they're not. Like Wallet of Satoshi and Strike and Shield, none of them are wallets. They're all custodial accounts where the government can freeze your money at any time. Or maybe they don't even have your money. Maybe they're already engaged in fractional reserve Bitcoining. We don't know. And so it's really really been disappointing to see how many people have drank the Kool-Aid and been fooled by it.
One thing that I think has been interesting, it kind of reminded me when you mentioned replace by fee, is replace by fee was an optional thing. And I remember in years past, BitRefill, which is, you know, one of my favorite services for living off of crypto, would accept instant Bitcoin transactions if your wallet had RBF disabled. And I remember that Sergey, good friend of mine, right, of the CEO of BitRefill, kind of coming out on the other side of the issue when RBF by default was sort of pushed to Bitcoin Core. I'm still not clear if that's part of the code today or not, but it was definitely a big sticking point with a lot of people where a lot of old school maxis, as it were, started to be like, wait a second, but we're still needing zero conf to be reliable for some things. Even though you can RBF, we want to be able to do no RBF if we need to. And so how much have you paid attention to Bitcoin, BTC, I should say, over the last like let's just say 2 to 3 years, because there's been some interesting developments there with like the ordinals situation and then a lot of mindshare shifts.
Yeah, I haven't paid nearly as close attention as I have in the past, but I did notice that like now they're trying to make replace by fee all the time for every BTC transaction. Like you said, some people are waiting, realizing, whoa, maybe that's not such a good idea. And then the other thing that I'm kind of like, I don't know, chuckling to myself about too, because like when SegWit first came, they gave a discount for the SegWit included data versus like the regular base part of the block size data. And like myself and Jihan and a number of others were complaining like that the SegWit transactions are unfairly cheap because like for 1,000 kilobytes worth of data, they'll pay less than 1,000 in SegWit, you'll pay less than 1,000 kilobytes of data in the rest of the block, even though it's 1,000 kilobytes of data, the network has to transmit it and do everything the same. And like, I don't know, like people weren't paying close enough attention or that argument was too complicated or too nuanced for them to say like SegWit data, SegWit transactions are unfairly cheap. Now they're making my exact same arguments about the SegWit data being unfairly cheap and that there's a subsidy for the SegWit data because they're mad about the ordinals and all the other stuff that's going on with the SegWit data. So it's like, I don't know, I was ahead of the curve complaining about that one. I think I was ahead of the curve complaining about the block size limit. I was ahead of the curve in promoting Bitcoin to the world. And, you know, I guess, you know, what do they say? Like, there's some expression that people, you know, visionaries are always demonized in their own time or something. I feel like I was ahead of the curve on all of those arguments. And now the, you know, now I can point back in history and say, see, told you so. But I'd rather than being able to say, see, told you so, I'd rather be living in a world where we have all these, you know, better useful technologies and more peer-to-peer cash for the world to use for everybody at the moment. But one more thing that maybe I'll be able to look back on time and say, see, I told you so, that I'm excited and interested about though. In the early days, everybody thought Bitcoin was totally anonymous. And when people found out that it wasn't basically totally anonymous, we saw a huge amount of commerce switch from Bitcoin to Monero because of the privacy, and some of it to Bitcoin Cash with Cash Fusion, and there's some other, you know, Zcoin and Zcash and some other things like that. And so the reason why is people wanted privacy. So they switched from BTC with no privacy, and then they tried to use Wasabi Wallet and some other things like that as well. But we've seen, you know, there's a real desire for that transactional privacy. So we saw a huge amount of commerce move from BTC to XMR, for example. And then Ethereum came along and everybody and their uncles doing tokens on Ethereum. So you have tokens. There's USDT, there's USDC, there's a zillion and one tokens out there. Everybody's doing tokens. My question is, where are the privacy tokens? What is the privacy token platform, right? There isn't one yet that I'm aware of. So I started looking. If we saw a bunch of commerce move from Bitcoin with no privacy to chains with privacy, I think we'll see tokens move from chains with no privacy to chains with privacy. And the best one that I've been able to see that's already out there right now available for people to use is one called Zano, Z-A-N-O. And it has user creatable. So anybody can make their own token. And the token has the same sort of level as of privacy as like a Monero transaction. And it's actually maybe even better than that, because when you're looking at the Zano blockchain, all you can see, like, let's say I send Roger token to you and Joel sends, you know, Joel token to somebody else and someone sends a stablecoin token to someone else on the blockchain. All you can see is that a transaction happened. You don't know which token was transacted in. You don't know, you know, who it was sent from, who it was sent to. You don't know how many of the tokens. All you can see is that some sort of a transaction happened. And the really, I think, interesting other exciting part about it, though, too, is that all the network fees on that network become burned. So as everybody makes these transactions, they get burned, which means at some point, if the network becomes popular, the entire network will be burning more of the gas token, which is Zano, than will be emitting it. So like, I think, you know, we already announced a couple of days ago, we're integrating this into the Bitcoin.com wallet. So Bitcoin.com users will have user creatable privacy tokens. And I'm real excited to see what the world will be able to do in regards to that sort of thing. So if people are interested in privacy tokens, please check out Zano, Zano.org.
Yeah, the privacy thing is definitely something that's been booming lately. I mean, last year there was a podcast special on this channel sponsored by Zcash, and I did a big deep dive into the whole Zcash world. Now, a friend of mine works for a project called Railgun, which adds basically Zcash level privacy to anything. And it's interesting enough, he's probably been in crypto for longer than you have, which is a very hard thing to achieve. And yeah, we're starting to see this kind of coalescence around the whole privacy thing. But just on the Bitcoin, the BTC developments, it's very interesting how, first of all, a couple years ago I saw a few prominent maxi influencers, I can't remember the specific ones, but mention very negative things about SegWit in retrospect, saying that part of it was very good as far as like malleability fixes, whatever. But the whole block weight kind of,
Changing the
unfairly.
economic
Yeah. So they
code
said
of
that,
Bitcoin.
and this is before Ordinals, by the way. There's a few that were saying, man, that was a big mistake on our part. That was really bad. So there's a couple who came around to that. Then Ordinals hit, which I'm semi-convinced was an intentional move to try to kind of like poke Bitcoin and see what happens, kind of thing. Kind of like force the question that has taken so many years to really force. And I kind of mentioned today on a space I was on about Bitcoin fees were unreasonable for a lot of people, but still reasonable for some people until Ordinals hit. And then that kind of forced the question on everyone of the experience that I had in 2016 was everyone's experience in 2023, for example. And as a result, I've seen a lot of people, a lot of Bitcoin people, whether it's Sergey or Bitrefill or some other people, kind of coming around to this "we need to do something" thing. An interesting thing is, I'm sure your dear friend John Carvalho, I'm sure you remember that guy, he is almost sounding like a Bitcoin casher today in a lot of the stuff he's saying. He's still, and I'll forward everyone their quirks and biases. He's still very much BTC only, everything else is shitcoin. Okay, whatever. But he's saying some stuff that's very interesting about needing to increase the block size, basically. And so it's kind of funny, right? Because of how full circle the whole thing comes from that initial interview. And I'm trying to give a lot of credit to someone who I disagree with on a lot of things. He did publish the entire script for the interview that he had with you publicly, so everyone could see all the questions he asked and was going to ask. And yeah, in my personal opinion, I think your reaction was very reasonable in that case. But it's kind of
And
interesting to
there'll be a
see.
lot of people that maybe they've only seen the meme. We should, recap what happened. So I don't know what year that was, 2018 or something like that. This guy, he contacted me asking to do an interview, which is fine. Like, I'm happy to do interviews and I'm happy to do debates. Like, I've had plenty of people say, hey, let's debate something or let's have a debate. I'm happy to do both. But this guy contacted me for an interview. And then it turned out it wasn't an interview. It was the same sort of interview you would see like Borat do when he gets some, famous person to, when he
Like
just
Ron
asked.
Paul when he punked Ron Paul.
Exactly. It was, and he just pushed my buttons and pushed my buttons for 45 minutes. And after 45 minutes, I lost my temper, gave him the middle finger and hung up on him. And and then that middle finger photo unfortunately became a meme that's all over the internet to this day. But like, I think his intention was to push my buttons and he succeeded. So congratulations to him for that. But it is interesting. I saw one of his recent interviews. It feels like today he's making almost all the exact same arguments that I was making to him back then. And interesting to see that come full circle as well.
Yeah, maybe just a little earlier. There's a lot of other people, like some of maybe the newer Bitcoin era people, like Russell Okung, who's an NFL player, was an NFL player, and he's famous for receiving a salary entirely in Bitcoin. Decided to experiment with Ordinals, then got sort of canceled by the maximalist bunch, and is sticking with his guns. And there's just a bunch of like these mainstream voices that are sort mainstream in the Bitcoin world that are sort of migrating a little bit more to a "we need to do something." And one thing for sure, the Ordinals effect on Lightning is a big part of that. So like, I used to run a Lightning node just because I don't want to form opinions without having firsthand experience, and I just want to know what I'm dealing with. And a lot of people were using Lightning, being very happy with it, because a $1, $2, $3 transaction to reopen or rebalance a channel is fine as long as you save on the other end. But then when you start to get 50, 60, $80 transactions, Lightning kind of breaks down, as of course I'm sure you are aware in the Lightning white paper. That was kind of, big blocks were kind of part of that. And I think that's sort of kicked a lot of people in high gear on this sort of thing, seeing that we need a bigger change. And oddly enough, it's pushed a little resurgence in Blockstream's liquid offering, which still is very much not used, but it's kind of peeking its head back in. But kind of the whole, in all this context, do you think that Bitcoin, BTC, as Bitcoin, I should say, is going to move in a positive direction as a result of this? Do you think that there's hope to be bullish on the future of BTC based on kind of some of these mindshare shifts? or do you remain sort of bearish on BTC and think that other things like Bitcoin Cash and the plethora of other cryptocurrencies that want to scale on chain are probably going to win out instead?
Cryptocurrencies as a whole are going to win for sure. Like that, I think, is kind of undeniable at this point. My biggest fear with BTC is that all these people that are building on top of it are building the financial prison walls around themselves, because with the small blocks and the high fees that come along with that, everyone just gets forced into using custodial platforms. And if you're using a custodial platform, that's exactly what governments want, because they can control everybody on that platform. Whereas if you're able to interact directly with the chain itself and not need a custodian, you're free to do what you want with your own money. And so that's a huge, huge difference. And so, like, I don't know, maybe the next cultural shift in the zeitgeist will be people realizing, wait a minute, Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin BTC are equally scarce, but Bitcoin Cash you can actually transact in directly yourself and not need to use a custodian. Like, maybe there'll be a shift on that at some point as well. But there's a lot of different, you know, cryptocurrencies out there competing for mindshare. And then, you know, as I'm sure you're aware too, like, AGI seems to be right around the corner. And you know, one of the opinions that people have out there is that, like, the only problem that us humans have that we need to be working on is to create an intelligence smarter than ourselves. And any problem after that isn't our problem to solve. And, like, I don't know if that's entirely true, but, like, it's an interesting way of looking at the world, right? Because once there's something that's, you know, smarter than all human beings combined, like, we don't have any problems left to solve in the world. That thing's going to figure out, like, we won't even be able to understand what the problems are that it's solving at that point. So hopefully it'll still be kind to us and, you know, leave us our little corner of the world to exist in. But the world's about to change more than, like, pretty much any of us can even imagine at this point, is kind of the way I see the next, you know, 10 to 20, 30 years.
Yeah, for sure. Or
maybe even faster, right?
So. 5 years. 5 years would be trippy, because I use a lot of different AI tools, from images to video to writing scripts to doing voiceovers and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting. On that sort of note of, so going, the premise of the book, and of course something I think that for people like us who, you know, were there, the hijacking of Bitcoin seems to be very deliberate and orchestrated to a certain extent. However, I'd like to kind of go in the opposite, kind of challenge that assertion, not necessarily specifically on Bitcoin, but the context of this is Ethereum, right? Ethereum came out, did a bunch of things different from Bitcoin. I think it succeeded a lot because it was kind of left alone by a lot of the Bitcoin people in the beginning, because it did something different. It wasn't competing in the same domain and was showing a lot of promise in the 2017 bull cycle. Came relatively close to flipping Bitcoin in market cap because it did a lot of stuff that you could not do on Bitcoin. However, then Ethereum today seems to be a lot like Bitcoin, where the gas limit has been intentionally limited. The, you know, the block size for Ethereum has been intentionally limited. Execution sharding was on the Ethereum roadmap, and it got kind of quietly removed to where most Ethereans don't even know that happened, that they're not trying to scale the base layer anymore. And Ethereum is now, there's a lot of money into L2 scaling, and the most recent upgrade, Dankun or whatever it was called, significantly made things better and easier for L2s, but did nothing for the base layer. So Ethereum has kind of become a subset of the Bitcoin problem, where it seems to be captured by a lot of corporate interests seeking to make, you know, rent seekers seeking to make profit off of these second layer solutions. And I had a podcast with Justin Bonds today that I just released that kind of breaks this down, because he's much more technically minded on these kinds of things. It sort of blew my mind. And in the context of, okay, there's a conspiracy against Bitcoin for sure, but was there the same conspiracy against Ethereum, or is there something fundamental that is, like, maybe a flaw or a weakness in the design of both of those, in the governance design maybe, that allows rent seekers to come in and sort of take it over and restrict its capacity so they can make money in selling their custodial centralized solutions where they make all the money? Have you thought about that concept?
Yeah, the biggest and most clear example of the rent seekers was Blockstream, right? They intentionally did everything they could to cripple Bitcoin and then tried to sell the world on their liquid sidechain where they make money on every single fee. So, like, that was clear as clear can be with with Ethereum, hard to know. Like it's happened twice now. You can argue with, Bitcoin and then again with Ethereum. Maybe that's just the way the world works and the way things are going to play out anytime anything gets big enough. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe we'll be wrong. There's two examples, but maybe there'll be a third that goes the other way, and we'll wait and see. And you have Solana's, the hot coin at the moment that seems to have outages every couple of months, and nobody seems to care one bit. And well, the short answer is I don't know. The longer answer is build the future you want to see as well. And so, get out there and look for something that needs doing and do it if you want to have it exist.
Yeah, it kind of it's an interesting point with for example, Bitcoin Cash had a bunch of different let's just say governance eras. Let's be a bit nice and say governance eras of, it was this way, and then a certain group branched out, and then another certain group, the founding group, in fact, branched out. And then now we have something right now. Everything was very peaceful for like a year or so, and then there was some like Reddit drama, but I don't know how seriously to take that. But basically, what I'm worried about, I guess, is the inability of if maybe this is a vulnerability in the system. And obviously, like for example, if you are in combat or something and someone bests you, the wrong move is to blame your opponent for being better than you. The right move is to say what weakness of mine did he exploit? And so I'm wondering if there's a weakness in these decentralized cryptocurrencies that someone's able to come in and rent seek and have an inability or an ability to sort of manipulate public opinion and do some astroturfing and troll farms and stuff, and then just sort of take that over. On the one hand, yes, they're bad people. Yes, they took it over. Yes, they did something wrong. On the other hand, do you think there's some sort of a weakness in the system that they exploited?
So, as a libertarian, I think you'll agree with me. Like, I think you could make that argument about human society as a whole. We have this weakness in that a small group of people can come in and trick everybody else into thinking that we need a ruling class to boss us around and tax us and draft us and enslave us and do all of those things. And like the majority of people say, oh yeah, if we didn't have a ruling class to boss us around, society would fall apart. And so like maybe that's just an argument about any big enough group of humans that they can be tricked and manipulated into thinking that you need to be bossed around by some people that are, basically the overlords of the system. And so I don't know, how do we change that? Maybe AI will figure that out and AI won't be susceptible to the same issues, but I don't know. I'm just a human.
Yeah, for sure. Now, the one thing I think was very interesting about this last decade or so, because I come into crypto knowing, a lot about some things, but nothing about crypto. And then I expected Bitcoin to last forever as I wanted it to, and it didn't. It changed. And there's a bunch of things that I'm learning along the way. And one thing that I maybe didn't fully anticipate was, as soon as Bitcoin did not turn out the way that I thought the global economy would reward, right? And then there's alternatives that objectively, if you're saying what is more secure, what is faster, what is easier to use, what has more utility, a lot of these kinds of things. I mean, Bitcoin Cash is kind of the flagship bearer of this, but there's so many other chains, whether it's a Dash, whether it's a Monero, whether it's Zcash, which Zcash traded for significantly higher than Bitcoin in the beginning and now is like exponentially lower, just so much lower. And you have so many of these examples of projects that showed a lot of promise, showed a lot of utility, but for some reason, face to face with Bitcoin, the free market did not reward nearly as well. Do you have any kind of what are your thoughts on that? Like, why did, the free market that's always right, that always should reward the good things, they always whatever, why did it keep on dumping capital into the thing that doesn't work, the broken thing, and the things that do work, that work well? Clearly, some people are using them, but it just n hasn't competed nearly as well in the free market, in the, let's say, relatively free market. Do you have any theories on how things turned out that way?
Yeah, so I kind of roll my eyes every time I hear the Bitcoin maximalists say the free market has spoken, it has chosen Bitcoin. It's like, Are you people really that stupid and that short-sighted to think the free market has spoken and chosen Bitcoin? Like, the free market is never, ever, ever done deciding. It's constantly deciding, right? Last year, you know, the dollar was the most popular thing. Next year, it'll be something else. Before iPhone, it was, you know, Nokia. Before Nokia, it was something else. Before Nintendo, it was Atari. And then after Nintendo, it's, you know, PlayStation. Like, the free market is never, ever, ever done deciding. So to, like, say, oh, the free market's decided it's chosen Bitcoin, like, you're either an idiot or you're willfully blind trying to, like, pump your own bags there. Like, to say, oh, the free market's decided, like, get off of it, right? And so in regards to that, and, like, the other side, too, this isn't a free market. It's not even close to a free market. The government's controlling everything. You have to get permission for this and permission for that. And they're arresting people for this and throwing software developers in jail for that. So it's not even remotely a free market. And then there's all the censorship on top of that. So, like, the whole idea that the market has decided and it's decided on Bitcoin, like, today, Bitcoin has the biggest, like, market cap of the cryptocurrencies. There is absolutely no guarantee that that's going to be the case tomorrow. And I think the one tomorrow that will have the biggest market cap will be the one that's the most useful to the most number of people for whatever it is they're trying to accomplish. And is it going to be Bitcoin? Maybe. Maybe it's going to be something else. But if you're just, like, an investor trying to make money on cryptocurrency stuff too, you know, take the advice from the great hockey player, Wayne Gretzky. You don't skate to where the money is, or you don't invest where the money already is. You invest to where the money's going to be, right? So he said, why is he good at hockey? Because he skates to where the puck's going to be, not to where it is currently. So if you want to make money in cryptocurrency today, invest in where the money's going to be, not where it already is. And so, like, what's the usefulness of Bitcoin? I don't know. Maybe they'll get their act together and make it useful for people to actually use for all sorts of things. But from my point of view, I think people want privacy on their financial transactions. I think people want privacy tokens. And so, like, I'm interested in those sorts of things. And so how good a job will governments do at disrupting privacy tokens and disrupting privacy, you know, chains? Like, pretty good. They've already, you know, I'm recording this from South Korea. It's already illegal for every exchange in the country to list Monero or Zcash or any of these privacy tokens.
I should also add to that, as far as I know, Litecoin got delisted from some exchanges in Korea because of Mimblewimble.
Yeah. So, and that's frustrating, but... You know, people want that. And, like, if you want privacy on Bitcoin, I guess you can use Wasabi Wallet, but what are the fees for that? You know, $100 or something, whereas on Bitcoin Cash, you can use Cash Fusion for less than a penny. On, you know, Monero, I think the fees are a couple of pennies. Zeno is a couple of pennies. Zcash out there. Like, and you were talking about earlier, we're talking about people attacking, like, their allies. Like, I'd like to see within the crypto community, like, there's been a huge amount of rivalry between Zcash and Monero. Stop it. You guys are both awesome. There's room for both you guys to exist in the world. Like, people deserve privacy. People can use both, right? It's not one or the other. Rather than fighting with each other, let's get more people into crypto that haven't used crypto at all, period. So, like, I'd love to see the infighting stop within the cryptos there as well. And I'd love to see a more discussion be allowed to take place than censorship. And unfortunately, there's been way, way, way more censorship of ideas within what I thought was supposed to be a community of people that were free thinkers and open to new ideas. Why are you busy censoring people? We've seen a lot of that happen, unfortunately.
Yeah, all of that is true. And I keep trying to think of, like, one thing that's been very useful in my life is whenever I run into a frustration is not think about the blame of someone else, but to think about, even though it is accurate, by the way, that someone else has wronged me in this case.
What can you do to fix it in your life, in this situation?
And so it is very interesting to see with, like, as soon as Bitcoin pivoted away from digital cash turned into so many different projects. And rather than unite, they seem to have all fought against each other for that shrinking piece of the pie rather than kind of come together.
Growing the pie as a whole. Yeah.
Yeah. And hopefully that's kind of, over and soon, but it has been a little bit frustrating for sure.
Yeah, although I guess one caveat, like, if you do see people building, like, the financial prison walls they're going to be imprisoned in, it's probably okay to sound the alarm and attack that and call that out. So, like, some of these custodial platforms that they're tricking people into thinking are wallets that aren't wallets, like, call them out. Like, if you're a custodial platform, don't call yourself a wallet, call yourself an account, so that people aren't deceived by that.
Yeah, which it's interesting because I think that the government's going to force that anyway, because a wallet of Satoshi is not available to U.S. users right now because
Because it's not a wallet.
Because it's a custodial service. The EU just passed some legislation. I don't know how when it's going to take effect. Probably I've heard people say about 3 years from now, but that basically forbids anonymous custodial crypto accounts and specifically exempts self-hosted, as they call it, right, as in non-custodial cryptos from having to do any KYC requirements, but says that if you are a custodian, you need to KYC your customers, in which case then Wallet of Satoshi can't operate in Europe either. And then pretty soon you start to see the fragmentation of the experience of like what is real and what isn't.
Yeah, all the more reason to actually use a wallet rather than an account. So well put.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I know you've mentioned a bunch of times the whole privacy angle. Obviously, I think it's very important. A lot of people think it's very important. But where did that become a particular thing for you?
It's always been important, not privacy for privacy's sake, but like one of the characteristics that makes money money is fungibility. Mm-hmm. And fungibility is just a fancier word for privacy, right? Like if your money's not fungible, it's not good money. So if you want money to be fungible, to work as money, it also has to be private. And so just purely from an economic standpoint, just looking at what makes something money, privacy has to be there, right? So like that's why Monero is better money from that privacy aspect or fungibility aspect than something like BTC, right? But the limited supply is also incredibly important. Monero doesn't have that beat on Bitcoin, but Bitcoin, you know, maybe they're going to have some security issues as well as the block reward dwindles over time and the price doesn't continue to go up to keep in pace with that. So like we'll see. There's all these, you know, different metrics here that you have to keep an eye on all of them. But like one of the really important things that makes money money is fungibility. And fungibility, like I said, it's just a fancy name for privacy. So if your coin doesn't have privacy, it's not good money.
Yeah, for sure. I've actually noticed a big resurgence in privacy over the recent years. Of course, I've been involved in privacy stuff since forever, but it's I've noticed, for example, Zcash is much more usable today than it ever was. I remember a friend of mine was doing command line transactions. It took 10 minutes to process a zero knowledge proof way back in the day to buy something, and now it's like a few seconds. I remember when Monero didn't have a GUI wallet, much less a mobile wallet, and now there's plenty of mobile wallets. We're
probably going to get that in the Bitcoin.com wallet here soon as well, just to promote that as well. So, it's a real wallet, not an account. Yeah. So.
Yes. I'm currently helping test the privacy beta of the Dash wallet right now. That's coming, and there's some internal talks to the community to give a big privacy boost, maybe on par or more than Monero. We'll see. Again, this is all, you know, not decided upon. But it seems like there's a lot of this, and there's a lot of privacy smart contract kind of things, projects coming up. Numata, Penumbra, there's a few others I've heard about. It seems like this is kind of coming up on the golden age of privacy, but it's still not something that the average person or the average crypto user cares about. As a prediction timeline, when do you think privacy is going to be the number one? Because, of course, there was like the ICO boom, and there's the NFT boom, and there's ordinals and all this kind of stuff, and then there's DeFi. When do you think privacy is going to hit as like the big thing that the crypto world is going crazy over?
I wish I could say that it would hit, but I don't think it ever is going to, because I think the fact of the matter is that most people just plain don't care. And look at all the stuff that Edward Snowden told us about all the spying that was going on. Did anything change? No, not. And the only thing that changed is he can't come to America now. So like, I wish people would care more, but, and I appreciate, you know, people like Naomi Brockwell getting the word out. And so the people that do care can be informed, but I'm not very optimistic about the world as a whole suddenly deciding to care and start to care. But I think the way we can move the needle on that though, is to have the businesses that, you know, have millions and millions of users build these privacy tools right into it. But like, I think you're a PGP user as well, as am I. Why is that not built into Gmail? Why is that not built into the, you know, OS X operating system? Why is it not built into Windows? Because of pressure by governments for them not to do that. And so that's part of one of the big problems. Whenever these institutions get big enough, governments pressure them directly not to introduce privacy tools directly into their platform for millions of users. So like it's just relegated to, you know, people that are really motivated to go and install some extra software from some more obscure place to be able to use it. And so like I'd like to see some of these big giant, you know, crypto businesses really support privacy in a big way. But especially as soon as they're like a publicly traded company or their cap table has too many, you know, holders in it, like it becomes really hard to do that. So, but, you know, maybe Dash will be able to do it. Maybe the Monero community, maybe Bitcoin.com will do it, like, or maybe all of them will be able to do it. I'd like to see it come into existence, but the bigger an organization gets, the more outside pressure there is. And, you know, nobody wants to go to jail. And I guess we should mention that yesterday was Ross Ulbricht's 40th birthday. He's been in jail more than a decade. Literally, all of us are here talking about cryptocurrencies today because of that website that he figured out how to build called the Silk Road that allowed people to buy and sell, you know, buy and sell anything they wanted that was peaceful without needing government permission. And so he's in jail until he dies. They're planning to never let him out. And then I heard about Bitcoin thanks to Ian Freeman, who heard about Bitcoin because of Ross Ulbricht and the Silk Road. Ian Freeman is now in federal prison as well for running a Bitcoin ATM. Yeah. So like both those guys are absolute heroes and both those guys are in federal prison, which I think just shows like what an evil empire the U.S. Federal government is. It's one of the most evil entities ever in the history of humankind. It's right up there, you know, murdering people by the millions and incarcerating people by the millions that don't deserve it. And so like, just want to point that out to like people, like just because you went to, you know, the U.S., you know, public school, which is just a euphemism for a mandatory youth propaganda camp. Don't think those people are your friends. Don't think they care about you. Don't think they're here to make the world a better place anyway, whatsoever. They don't care about you one darn bit. They're just out for themselves and they'll, you know, literally murder people to get their way. So that's why crypto is so important, because it empowers individuals to have control of their own lives and basically bypass and replace that sort of existing system with a system where people are in control of their own lives.
Yeah, which is a sort of sobering reminder of sort of the cost of being early on this kind of thing, of being early to be principled and right. And I do remember, I think I got my first Bitcoin, started using it a month or two before the Silk Road is officially shut down. And so my entire experience has been kind of like married to the idea of this is something for the Silk Road, for example. And it's kind of interesting because that led into other things such as Open Bazaar back in the day. And then the very good friend of mine, Chris Pacia, who's the back-end developer of Open Bazaar, is at the end of the year now launching his own zero-knowledge privacy project. And so there's like, as I try to tell people, you know, liberty is going to win, crypto is going to win, but that doesn't mean that just because those are unstoppable and unkillable, it doesn't mean that the people involved with them are. And just be very careful about what you do as you go along, because you could be one of those people that pays the ultimate price for this. And it is, you know, it's sad. It's a little somber kind of footnote, but I am seeing a lot of very healthy things in the good direction. I don't know how much you've kept up with the cross-chain DeFi space, pioneered by ThorChain, but then which Eric Voorhees is very big into.
And if I can circle back to one other topic related to that, though, too, like maybe crypto is indestructible, maybe liberty is going to win in the end for sure, but that doesn't mean individuals within those movements are indestructible. Mm-hmm. And it's like one other example of that, you know, we talked about Ian Freeman, the host of Free Talk Live, where probably one of the other, you know, just really, really powerful tools to drive crypto adoption to the world and spread the word about Bitcoin, is in jail right now. There are, you know, two other people that were living in New Hampshire. I won't name them by name because I don't want the government to go after them even more. But like, I think they fled New Hampshire just in time. They were running a payment processing business for crypto in New Hampshire. And when they saw Ian get arrested, they fled and they're living somewhere else now. I think that they're going to be fine for the rest of their lives because they fled. And like, you know, don't be the Jew in Germany think, oh, they're never going to come for me. Like, I'm just going to stay put. Like, if things look like they're getting too hot, leave. You only get one life. You know, you don't spend it in prison. If where you're at is looking like it's getting too dangerous, go and flee and go somewhere else. Look into getting as many citizenships as you can from countries that are likely to leave you alone. Don't just have one passport because then you're at the mercy of that one country. Really look into, like, you know, diversifying yourself in terms of, you know, citizenships and passports and that sort of thing as well. And if things are looking bad where you're at, leave. I think that's the safest and best thing to do, is just plain leave if it looks too dangerous where you're at.
Yeah, and that's a great, not only is a great advice for life, but it's also a great allegory for crypto, right? And that's kind of what I did, because I joined Bitcoin. I was very much focused, even though it was never a maximalist, I was very much focused on Bitcoin for a while. And when it became too hot from a, can I still use this to live without a bank account, without KYC, without all this kind of stuff, then I jumped. And I think that a lot of people are starting to sort of do the same thing. But yeah, as far as like the, as I was mentioning, the cross-chain type space, I don't know how familiar with ThorChain, that really facilitates a lot of that kind of stuff. But then already there's many Thor children, as it were. The Maya protocol is one that I'm very familiar with because they're a fork of ThorChain, the complementary fork that is focusing on listing Dash and Zcash and some others. And then there's another one coming up, hopefully by the end of the year, called the Sarai Dex, which will list Monero, and they'll all be interoperable with each other. So then now you can be delisted from all the centralized exchanges you want. As long as you're somewhere in crypto, you can get access to all these things. And so that's kind of a beautiful thing I see coming up. There's been a lot of, I guess, conversation about how anonymous the teams are associated with this because of the Tornado Cash kind of incidents. I know for a fact that the Maya protocol team doesn't have bank accounts or anything, because I've done some work with them, and they don't have any of that stuff because they don't exist according to, you know, those structures. But what do you think about the future of the centralized exchange versus the decentralized exchange? Because Binance has gotten really bad treatment, right? And I'm not, how deserved, I'm not into Binance's business, right? But as far as, it seems like they've been shaken down in a serious way. A lot of exchanges like Bittrex, I believe, shut down. I can't remember which one of those was one that shut down. A bunch of OKXs shutting down a bunch of things. And it seems like it's kind of a Dex or die situation these days. Now, are you optimistic? Yeah. Are you optimistic about the crypto world just shifting, the centralized exchanges kind of going away and transitioning to the decentralized? Or do you think there's still like a battle we haven't yet fought?
I don't think, and again, I'm just guessing, but I don't think the decentralized exchanges are going to go away. I think that those will continue to exist. But I think that the amount of decentralized exchanges, including, I was just talking with the guys yesterday here at the ETH conference, they're building a decentralized exchange with literally an order book, right? Where you can have an order book right there. And like, I think that's a really big deal. And so like, I think you'll see the institutions continue to use centralized exchanges, but like just individuals, like any day of the week, I would rather, you know, trade something on Uniswap than on any centralized exchange. Like, it's just so much easier to use Uniswap than, you know, I don't even have to log in, right? Just click connect and then swap whatever I want and boom, I'm done. So just the user experience is so much better. Like other than like, you know, I guess some of these gas fees that are an issue, but I think yes. I think we'll see the main just average user will be using these DEXs, and then maybe you'll still see like the big institutions will still use the centralized exchanges, but there's definitely room for both without any doubt. But as the infrastructure gets better and better on the DEXs, I think we'll see more and more people using the DEXs. And I hadn't heard the term, you know, DEX or die, but mm-hmm. I think for the freedom aspect of the world, like bringing freedom to the world, yeah, the DEX or die.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's kind of interesting because Trust Wallet, which is, I believe, a Binance product, uses ThorChain for its backend swaps, for cross-chain swaps. And I remember some Twitter thread somewhere where CZ, again, Binance's founder and CEO, or former CEO, I should say, I think he's former, he was not aware that Trust Wallet was even using Thor. He didn't know what ThorChain was, but yet his company product was kind of using that backend. And it's kind of an interesting it's kind of interesting how like Dex rails are starting to get integrated into these legacy solutions without them even knowing.
Yeah. And when a company or organization gets as big as Binance is, like, there's no way anybody could expect CZ to know everything that's going on at an institution that big. And like another example of like US, just, you know, CZ is one of the best entrepreneurs in the history of the world. Mm-hmm. Tossing him in jail, right? They fined him what, $4 billion of his personal money. I think that's the most anybody's ever had to pay in a personal fine and still do jail time on top of it. So it just shows just how evil and vindictive the US government can be to do something like that to CZ.
Yeah, one of the most interesting parts of that, obviously that's it's tragedy, etc. But one of the most interesting fallouts from that is after that, Binance cracked down on privacy assets. And
Monero got delisted recently. The price dropped by, you know, like a third. And
and then
really
recovered.
yeah.
Yeah, but I think it was interesting because I'm good friends with Ruben of Vero, which used to be called Zcoin, and as well as I'm very close to the Zcash community, and they managed to avoid delisting through some sort of adding an exchange-only address format, so it just has transactions have to come from a transparent address, so the exchange can say this is the address it came from, and that's it. And it's kind of interesting how that's not a legal requirement because Gemini, which is probably the most regulated exchange in the world, supports fully encrypted Zcash transactions, but Binance cannot have any more legal restrictions. But because they're kind of being held hostage by the government right now, they can have their arm twisted a little bit more extra legally beyond what the law requires, and then they're kind of
Oh,
doing
yeah.
this.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize just how big a deal like the extra legal arm twisting of businesses are. Like businesses are terrified, and even if there's no enforcement action, and even if they're not required to by law, they still have to bend over backwards to do all sorts of things. So there's a huge amount of pressure. And like, why do you think like it's not illegal for Coinbase to integrate Monero, right? Why do you think they haven't, right? Why do you think like, these other companies haven't? It's because they're scared, right? The fear is a real thing. So.
Yeah, for sure. Well,
And it's justified fear. It's not unjustified fear. Like if they did do something like that, they probably would be gone after. So.
and that's one thing I respect Jesse Powell of Kraken for doing is he's in the same boat as Gemini, as Coinbase, as everyone else. He just seems to be a lot more vocal about the actual threats coming at him. He's like, "Look, we got to do this because of this." And while voices support for privacy is a human right, voice support for Monero, while at the same time in the UK, Kraken cannot list Monero. And so, obviously it'd be better if it was a completely decentralized exchange, but like as far as doing a good job right there, it's a good sign.
So maybe actually we were talking about everybody trying to help the ecosystem as a whole grow. I didn't realize that you were friends with some of the Bitrefill people, but for a longest time they haven't taken Bitcoin Cash. Bitcoin Cash is awesome as peer-to-peer cash. Maybe you can mention to them, hey, the Bitcoin civil war is over. People know the difference. Like it's time to let all the Bitcoin Cash users be able to use their great product because Bitrefill has an awesome product and they accept a whole bunch of coins. I think Bitcoin Cash has never been one of them. I think maybe now is a good time to change that. And I'll gladly make sure we do a real nice article about them on Bitcoin.com promoting that when that happens. So you can maybe reach out and see if they're open to,
Yeah.
extending the branch on that front as well, because
Yeah.
crypto should be for everybody.
Well, definitely. And I mean, not to reveal too much stuff, but they did come to me at some point asking about Bitcoin Cash in particular at some point while evaluating. So it's not like they're completely shunning it. They have their eye on it, and they're I can't speak for them obviously, but it seems like they're appraising the whole situation, right? They're not being crazy maxis. I can just
Okay.
say
And
that.
then one other example too that I love, like Bitcoin Cash has this thing called Cash Fusion. And I was talking to another guy, and he's like, oh, Chainalysis can track all your Bitcoin Cash transactions. They know everything you're doing. And I said, no. You don't know about Cash Fusion? He's like, no, what's that? And I explained to him, it's basically you're shuffling your inputs and outputs with a whole bunch of other people's. And I said, give me your address. I'll send you some Bitcoin Cash, and you can have your friends at Chainalysis do an analysis on it. And so I withdrew funds from a normal exchange everybody's heard of. Sent it through only a single round of Cash Fusion and then sent those funds to him. And then he had Chainalysis do their analysis. He sent me the report. Chainalysis got every single thing wrong. They knew nothing about the origin of the fund. So it was really nice and neat to see that. And again, it costs you like, less than a penny to have privacy on Bitcoin Cash using Cash Fusion and the
And
Electron Cash.
it's crazy because according to like the I guess the privacy landscape of things, that's one of the what one could call one of the weaker privacy functions there. Because for example, like the minimum Dashcoin joining thing is 4 rounds, mostly it's 16 rounds before you're kind of safe to do. Monero has stealth addresses as well that are confidential transactions, so you don't even see amounts. Zcash is a completely zero knowledge and stuff. I'm sure a state level actor could maybe start to correlate some off-chain data or something like that. But as far as like any explicit privacy function, and maybe this is like a preaching moment rather than just an interview moment, right? If you're out there using cryptocurrency, use any kind of privacy enhancing technique at all, any of them, and you will probably be a lot safer than you were before. petty thieves won't be able to track you, et cetera, et cetera. You know, are you hiding from the IRS? That's a different story, maybe. But as far as like, just do whatever you can, just do something, I think it'll work.
And yeah, I guess that's why I want to promote the idea of privacy tokens again. So just yesterday, I was buying some other, you know, stuff, tokens, and I was paying with USDT. And I really didn't feel comfortable. Like, oh, I'm sending these guys, you know, a smallish amount of money compared to the amount of Tether that's in the wallet. And I know this guy can see exactly how much Tether is in my wallet every time I'm sending a transaction to him. And like, that guy's fine, but maybe somebody else is going to see, or like, you know, it's really an uncomfortable feeling. And so that's why I'm really bullish on the idea of privacy tokens. And I would much rather use, you know, Tether or whatever else on something like on Zeno, or whatever, you know, Railgun gets their act together and has, you know, easy to use stuff. Like, I want to use privacy tokens. Like, I think privacy tokens are the next big craze in crypto. And so it won't be privacy for privacy's sake, but like, nobody wants the other person they're paying to know exactly how much money they have in their account when they pay them. And like, privacy tokens are the answer. And by tokens, I mean like user issuable tokens, not a privacy token like a Zcash or a Monero, but like where you can make your, you know, Joel token or Desert Links token or whatever you want to call it. And I'll make my Roger token, and we have total privacy in regards to that. And I'm real excited and interested in that. And that's why I've been, I think most of your audience are, you know, libertarian types that are probably focused on that. Check out Zano, Zano.org. I'm pretty excited and interested in that.
Yeah, to sort of add to something you're saying about like not knowing how much money you have, there's a Indonesian restaurant in Amsterdam that I went to last year that I'm going to certainly visit again that accepts Bitcoin for payments. The BTC, it's the only crypto they accept, but they've accepted it for quite some time in a static address and static QR code. And so after paying them, of course, I looked up, you know, how many people have paid them, and you know, it's a great fodder for saying like, oh wow, this is, they get like a couple maybe crypto payments a year. It's not that much, which is unfortunate. But then also at the same time, why do I know how much money you have? You know, this is not. This is on that sort of subject of living on crypto and stuff, have you noticed in my sphere, because my voice has been getting bigger and I've encountered more people who are living on crypto as well, just decide to spend mostly crypto or all crypto or close their bank accounts or whatever. I know quite a few people, including some people doing this with BTC, which is, you know, an interesting choice, harder, but they're still doing it and et cetera. So my vision is, from my, you know, eyesight, many more people are living on crypto than were just a few years ago. But I have a very small vision. I'm very biased, et cetera. What are you seeing? Are you seeing more people start to use this? Is it kind of like, a couple more? Are you seeing fewer people living on crypto? Like, as far as like, I don't need fiat anymore, I'm just using crypto kind of thing. Where's the trend going as far as you've been able to observe?
I think the trend is definitely going in the direction of people being able to use more and more crypto. But when I say crypto, in this case, I have to include like USDT and USDC. Like, in my own life too, like I've had a number of, you know, like big recurring like monthly bills, or even for example, like lawyers. I pay all of my lawyers in crypto. Some of them take Bitcoin Cash. Other ones just want like USDT or USDC. But like, I'm not using a bank. I'm sending them crypto to pay for that sort of thing too. And of course, like normal stuff too, like, I can do all my shopping online with crypto and pay for most things. Like, sometimes it's a little bit of extra work, but like doing it in crypto. But the other nice part too, like, I'm not an American anymore. I don't have to deal with like all the, you know, crazy reporting laws anymore. Like, it makes it so much easier. Consider, you know, going and getting a second citizenship and not having to deal with, you know, depending on what country you're from. Like, if you're from America, like, man, I feel like you're in the kettle that's about to start to boil, right? Be that frog that jumps out, not the frog that sits there and continues to wait. So you can actually head on over to passportsforcrypto.com. And, you know, I set up that website to help people. I kind of feel like it's a modern day, you know, underground railroad where, like, you know, it's not Harriet Tubman. It's the Silk Road. Yeah. But helping people, escape from the oppressive systems into systems that are less oppressive. And you can pay for the whole thing in crypto nowadays. So.
Yeah, so why don't we just wrap up on what are you working on these days and what are you most excited about going forward? I mean, we talked a lot about a big spectrum of things, but a lot of it was, you know, oh, bad things happened. But what's the light at the end of the tunnel? What are you super excited about that you're, and what are you actually working on yourself as far as you can divulge?
Bad things happen, but you have to deal with it in your own life and make sure that you're going to be okay. So the main things I guess I'd love to promote to people that I'm involved in directly is that passportsforcrypto.com. If you want to get citizenship somewhere else, that's the place to start. And I'll connect you with whatever you need to know on that front. Go and buy my book. If you want to learn about the history of Bitcoins, hijackingbitcoin.com. So hijackingbitcoin.com on that. Of course, I still love Bitcoin Cash. Like Bitcoin Cash has lots of great usefulness going on, like all sorts of features. It really works well as cash. But I want to point out to people, I was never a Bitcoin maximalist. I was never a Bitcoin Cash maximalist. I put up the seed money to start Zcoin, the second round of Zcash. I'm literally like the co-founder of Ripple. Like a lot of people don't know that. Like I was literally the second person ever involved in Ripple there as well. Of course, Bitcoin Cash more recently, I'm getting more and more excited about the privacy tokens that I keep mentioning with Zeno.org. And yeah, I think those are the main things. And then like, man, AI is just about to change the whole world there too. You know, AI is not going to be opening a bank account. AI is not going to be passing any KYC checks. It's going to be using crypto to pay other AIs and going to pay humans to do its bidding. And like us humans are going to be paying AI with crypto. So like, it's not the legacy system. It's crypto that AI is going to be using as money. And so that's really interesting, exciting to me as well. And who knows, maybe AI will set up the next Silk Road competitor. And then who are the prosecutors going to prosecute at that point? That'll be pretty interesting as well. So yeah, I don't know. Check out all those ideas and just keep an open mind, right? Just because somebody tells you something's true doesn't mean it is true. So go ahead and think for yourself. And yeah, I guess that's the best advice I can give anybody. Think for yourself. And just because the common narrative out there is something or other, doesn't mean it's true, right? Every kid that's less than 7 years old believes that Santa Claus is real. It's not true. Well, maybe there's something else that every 70-year-old and below believes is true. Maybe that's not true also. So you need to stop and think for yourself.
Yeah, definitely. As the old adage is, Dior, or do your own research, which is kind of used as a sort of throwaway, but it's something that very few people actually do. Yeah, it's definitely interesting to see how things have gone. And I definitely agree with a non-maximalist sort of take. One thing that's definitely been very, I would say, maligned, going back to sort of like the book and the history of the takeover of Bitcoin and all that, is I remember a time when there was a big block camp and you were not in it yet. You were not the public figurehead of it yet, but most people, the narrative doesn't say that. And I remember there was a time, I believe I interviewed you at one point, and Bitcoin Cash was a thing and you were not involved at all in the slightest yet.
I was still focused on Bitcoin because I thought Bitcoin had a chance at scaling to become money for the world. And it wasn't until it became clear that it wasn't. That's when I decided, okay, Bitcoin Cash seems to have the best shot. But I bought a bunch of Dash as well, and Monero and Zcoin and Zcash, and you know, hedged my bets across a bunch of different things that I thought had a good chance of becoming money for the world.
Yeah, as an intelligent person would do. Well, this has been quite interesting, very, very good chat. I think a lot of people learn a lot from this. Where can people follow you and your work more closely?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been trying to take a step back into private life mostly. So like occasionally I'll tweet something on Twitter. I'm at Roger K. Veer on Twitter. If you want to see just my personal life, not particularly crypto related, I'm just at Roger on Instagram, and I have rogerveer.com. But I'm kind of looking forward to, you know, having my private life back a bit and just being able to enjoy things. I'm 45 years old now, right? Like not that young anymore. So I want to enjoy the time I have left until AI figures out how to do this, you know, extreme life extension stuff. So
I would have thought 33, but that's good.
Well, thank you, Joel. And thank you for the platform today. I appreciate it. And I always enjoy my conversations with you. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, thanks for chatting, and thanks everyone for watching.